Now, it's most encouraging to see a very good number tonight again. We make you all very welcome at the meeting. Thank you for coming. And just to remember, tomorrow night, if you're able to help at that meeting as well, your help will be greatly appreciated. Tomorrow night again at 8 o'clock in the will of the Lord. Now, we're reading again in the first epistle to the Corinthians, and we'll start to read in chapter 15. 1 Corinthians and chapter 15. And verse number 58. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as ye know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. Now, chapter 16. Now, concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given order to the churches of Galatia, even so do ye. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store, as God hath prospered him, that there be no gatherings when I come. And when I come, whomsoever ye shall approve by your letters, them will I send to bring your liberality unto Jerusalem. And if it be meet that I go also, they shall go with me. Now I will come unto you when I shall pass through Macedonia, for I do pass through Macedonia. And it may be that I will abide, yea, and winter with you, that ye may bring me on my journey, whithersoever I go. For I will not see you now by the way, but I trust to tarry a while with you, if the Lord permit. But I will tarry at Ephesus until Pentecost, for a great door and effectual is opened unto me, and there are many adversaries. Now, if Timotheus come, see that he may be with you without fear, for he worketh the work of the Lord, as I also do. Let no man therefore despise him, but conduct him forth in peace, that he may come unto me, for I look for him with the brethren. As touching our brother Apollos, I greatly desired him to come unto you with the brethren, but his will was not at all to come at this time, but he will come when he shall have convenient time. Watch ye, stand fast in the faith, quit you like men, be strong, let all your things be done with charity. I think maybe that's as far as we take our reading tonight. I don't want to be repeating much of the material that we covered last night and using up some of tonight's time, but I will just have to make one or two remarks that will enable us to link on and enable those who have only been able to come tonight to see exactly what we are attempting to do. We paid particular attention last night and put particular emphasis upon the fact that the expression, the work of the Lord, is one that we only find twice in the New Testament. It occurs at the end of 1 Corinthians chapter 15, always abounding in the work of the Lord. And then the second and only other occurrence is in chapter 16, where we have read tonight in verse number 10, Timotheus, he worketh the work of the Lord, as I also do. And we were making a good little bit to do last night of the fact that many have considered 1 Corinthians chapter 16 to be a kind of an appendage put on to the other 15 chapters of the epistle. They consider that all the great problems have been dealt with. The apostle Paul has reached his climax and his conclusion at the end of chapter number 15, and he has a jumble of miscellaneous matters that he wants to mention, and so he puts them on at the end, and they nearly speak of it as though it wouldn't matter very much if the last page had fallen off, so long as we had the first 15 pages of this great epistle. Well, we know that we don't treat the pages of the Bible like that, and I think we'll try and prove before the three meetings are over that we would have lost a tremendous amount if 1 Corinthians 16 had not been preserved to us. I think, I mentioned last night, I think that chapter 16 grows like a tree out of a root. The root is verse 58 of chapter 15. The root tells us that we should always be abounding in the work of the Lord. The question arises, what exactly is the work of the Lord? Chapter 16, with all its variety, different people and different plans, and different periods and different places, chapter 16 tells us exactly what the work of the Lord is. It's not just a theological statement that's high pie in the sky, but the work of the Lord is done by flesh and blood and bone and people just like us. And how that work was carried on in the first century around Corinth and these other places, we are told in chapter 16, people working in different places, people moving to different places, traveling and visiting. The work of the Lord was done then, very much as it is done even to the present day. And I think chapter 16 has many practicalities to give us. We mentioned last night that one very vital part of the work of the Lord is the sharing of material goods. That's where the chapter commences. Paul's collection for the poor saints in Jerusalem. The wealth and the material things of Christians in one part of the world being sent to people, Christians in need in another part of the world, that was part of the work there. It's a very vital and important part of the work still. I suppose when we come to the expression, the Lord's work, we have to watch our language. We talk about the foreign work. I'm not objecting to that. We all know what we mean. I've used that expression myself, and you use it. The foreign work and the foreign worker. You would nearly think that Northern Ireland was the headquarters of the work of the law. And everything that was going on anywhere else was foreign work. Where is the headquarters of the work of the Lord? It's heaven. So that no matter where we are located geographically, we are just all involved in one great work. The great thing that the Lord is doing in and through his people, and the headquarters and the direction from it all, for it all, they come from heaven. Then another little bit that we talk about, not strictly right, we say about a fellow when he gives up his secular employment, he's going into the Lord's work. That's great stuff, isn't it? He would need to do some business then. He's going into the Lord's work. Well, if he hasn't been in the Lord's work before he does that, I think it would just be maybe a false start. He needn't bother. Another thing I have great difficulty with is there are people have tremendous interest. I've no difficulty with this part of it. This is a great thing. We would encourage this. But there are people have great interest in the Lord's work 2,000 miles from where they live. But they seem to have practically no interest in a 5-mile circumference of their own house. I find a great difficulty. You people probably have a very ready explanation for it. I really cannot understand people being enthused about the Lord's work in the South Sea Islands and away down yonder in the Antarctica. And if you had a series of gospel meetings 200 yards from their door, if they made it one night a week, they would think they had put in a marvelous performance. The work is one. And it's grossly inconsistent for me to have a big interest away, 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 away out yonder, and to show a minimal interest here. I don't want to discourage the interest out yonder. Keep it going. But then, keep it going at home as well. It's all one work, and it's a great privilege to be involved in it. One thing about the Lord's work that we can be absolutely sure about is that it will never fall upon times of unemployment. We hear a great deal about the unemployment problem in our country. There will never be any unemployment crisis in the Lord's work. There's always plenty to do. And generally speaking, I have heard the Christian comment that there's more to do than people to do it. So no one need ever say, well, you know, I would love to do it, but there's nothing for me to do. There's plenty for all. There's work for the old. And there's work for the young. There's work for the rich. There's work for the poor. There's employment for the professional. There's great employment for the uneducated. We've just been singing that all ages and ranks can be employed. And when it comes to the work of the Lord, I think there could be a publication given any time outlining situation data. There's a great need for nurses, you know. Because in traveling about a little bit from here to there, I mean just in this little province, I can see that there's a tremendous need for people just to care. Nurses. Situations vacant. A great need for shepherds. Situations vacant. A great need for teachers. Situations vacant. A great need for seed sowers. A great need for builders. There's a tremendous variety of tasks involved in the Lord's work. And there's no one should ever find himself or herself among the unemployed. If you do find yourself like that, and if I find myself in such a situation, it will be with us as it is outside. There are many dear folks out there who can't find work. We have sympathy with them. Maybe some of you in here like that. But then there is a great number out there, and they don't have work because they don't want it. And it would be too bad if that same spirit would ever creep in amongst us. There are many who just don't want to get involved, and that's a very... One thing I have to tell you, that the Lord's work is very long hours. You say, well, I'm looking for a 4-day week. Well, all I tell you is, if you're going to sign a contract of employment, you say, but have you to sign a contract of employment? I tell you, the very night you trusted Christ the Savior, you had signed a contract of employment. You had engaged yourself in a commitment to full-time service for the Lord who redeemed you. Lock, stock, and barrel, head and hand and foot had been redeemed by His precious blood. You signed the contract of employment at conversion, and it's 7 days a week from there until they get to glory. Tears, trials, toils. There are trials as well, but the work of the Lord is certainly a very, very demanding business. One thing I'm really disappointed to have to tell you this in the modern climate. One thing about the Lord's work is I have never yet discovered any little indication in this book of an early retirement. You don't get out of 50. And you don't get out of 60. And you don't get anything like that. Half of you people are now just waiting until I can get redundancy and I get paid off and I get out of 50. No, no. You keep going on and on and on and on. And you say, well, then we get to heaven. We get an everlasting holiday. I think you don't. You only start working when you get to heaven. When you get into the kingdom, this is only the apprenticeship. This is only the apprenticeship. And God has big jobs in the everlasting. The work of the Lord is going to run on for all eternity. And I tell you, there are some big posts coming up. And if I make a fumble of a Sunday school star, you can't even depend on me to turn up. The Lord's looking somebody for the big post. He says, sure, he couldn't even handle a Sunday school star.
This is only the apprenticeship. You people who are students here tonight, do your best at your studies.
But don't put so much into the works of man that you find yourself missing out in the work of the Lord. Because we are apprentices in training and in testing. The assessment day is coming for the apprenticeship when we stand at the judgment seat of Christ. And I tell you there's going to be some surprises when the different posts and allocations are made at the judgment. The Lord's work, so that if we have a little part in it, we would like to make sure that we're doing it well, profitably. Now that'll bring us in a little bit more to some of the things of the chapter. As I said, I'm not at all going to go back on the business of the collection. That's a very important thing. One of the great matters in which the Lord is testing us is how we handle material things. That's a big test. That's an important part of our apprenticeship. But I'm not going back on that. That's the first four verses of the chapter. But having looked at Paul's collection and the details that he gives about it, I want to come from verses number 5 down to verses number 9. And in that section of the chapter, we have the details given of Paul's calendar. At least that's what I called it. We could have called it Paul's coming, because quite a number of times in the section he mentions the fact that he's hoping to come to Corinth. But I've called it his calendar for reasons that you'll see just now. The first thing that I want to mention is that in this little section of 4 or 5 verses, the Apostle Paul outlines the aims that he has for the immediate future. Now he says, I'm here at Ephesus. And then he says, I'm hoping to go through Macedonia. And he said, after I've gone through Macedonia, I'm hoping to come down and visit you people at Corinth. And he said, those are the plans that I have immediately in mind. It's interesting to see that those plans cover approximately a year. He says, I'm here in Ephesus and I would like to stay until Pentecost. That's verse number 8. He says, I would like to stay until Pentecost. Now, Pentecost would have been roughly the end of May or June. It hadn't arrived yet. So the Apostle Paul is writing this letter sometime in the spring of a year. He says, Pentecost coming. Then he says, I'm going to go to Macedonia, and he says, I'll get down round to you, it'll be late autumn. And he says, when I get to you at Corinth, he says, I hope to spend the winter at Corinth, which is I couldn't travel anywhere else, I couldn't cross the sea in the winter period. And he said, I'll spend the winter in Corinth. That will take me through into the spring of the next year. So he's moving from the spring of 1 year through to the spring of the next year. And he has in his mind certain plans and certain aims that he would like to see achieved. Now, just to speak about that for a minute, we are not apostles, we know that. But I think it's a good thing that in the work of the Lord, we wouldn't just be drifting along aimless. Any of you folks who are involved in public works at all, they'll have what they call a forward planning system. And they'll give you the short-term plan. And then they'll have the mid-term plan. And then they'll have the long-term, maybe a 10-year thing, a forward planning thing. Now, in the work of the Lord, I may be wrong now. I'm only making a suggestion on the basis of this passage. And I say, it's not apostles, but I'm thinking just now of assemblies, and probably overseers, especially in the assemblies. They should have within their mind a number of things that they would like to see achieved within, say, the next year. But you say, sure, we should be thinking about the Lord's coming. Well, Paul was thinking about that. That was the end of the previous chapter. He says the Lord's coming, the trumpet will sound. But even though he was living in the good expectation of the Lord's coming, he still had certain things that he wanted to see accomplished. You know, I have noticed in life that people who aim at nothing usually succeed in happiness. What aim do you have for the assembly? Any new area that you would like to see visited? Any new family that you would like to see especially contacted? Leaving it out as an assembly. I want to speak to some of the younger ones here because it's a great encouragement to see all the students that have taken time out just to come to the meeting like this tonight. I want to speak to you now in a very simple way. I know it's moving over a good bit for application from this chat, but in your spiritual life as a Christian before the Lord, you should have aims. How do you read your Bible, for example? I just let it drop open and read a wee psalm or something. But if that's the way you read your Bible, it's all right. I'm not condemning that, but remember, you'll never make any headway spiritually. What about making a name, though? I did it. I still do it. I'm not That doesn't make it right or anything, make it worth anything at all. But I just don't read the Bible aimlessly. And I don't read it as much as I should and think about. But I have certain things that I would like to see studied. I'm ashamed to tell you there are books of the Bible I know absolutely nothing about. Well, that's not exaggerating. I know practically nothing about. I know where to find them, and I know what you call them. And I could maybe tell you for about two-thirds of them how many chapters are in them. But I know practically nothing, and I'm just waiting for the day. I have a thing in my mind. Someday I'll be able to sit down a number of weeks and get into that book, and I hope that I don't meet Isaiah any time in the near future.
But you need a plan, because if you just drift, people that aim at nothing.
I say again, generally succeed in heaven. Now Paul had aim that he wanted to see fulfilled. But I think it's very precious to notice that in the midst of outlining and announcing these different plans that he had in mind, he put in here and there a number of little additions, because he knew that no matter what plans I made, there can always be changes. And we have got a page out of his diary here. He must have had a diary, at least a mental one anyway, this idea. He got us to get a page out of his 1 year diary. And he tells us in verse number 6, verse 5, he gives us the first big journey. When I passed through Macedonia, verse 6, it may be. You get that word, don't you? He said it may be. He said it may not be. He said I'll do my best, and that's what I would like to do. But he said I can't guarantee it. It may be. And then verse 7, he says, I hope to tarry a while with you, if the Lord permits. Wasn't that the way to make all his arrangements? He says, these are things that spiritual ambitions I would have, but he said, I may have to adjust them. Indeed, he got into trouble. He got into great trouble with these Corinthians, because he maybe once suggested to them that he would do one plan, and then he had to change it. And he said to me, you couldn't believe that fella. He told us he'd be here 6 months ago, and he's only coming now. You couldn't believe him. And they made a whole furore about it, and they made the allegation that the Apostle Paul was an untruthful man that couldn't be depended upon. You see, the first plan that he had was, you know your geography, don't you? If you're looking at the map facing you now, not me looking, but if you're looking at the map, you have Ephesus here, and you have a staple-shaped thing, and the sea in between it, Corinth over here. Now, he could have gone across the sea, Corinth. That was the first plan he had. And he told them, I'll go over the sea to you people, and I'll go and do some, and then he says, I'll come back, and I'll give you 2 visits. That didn't materialize. Hey, that's why Calvin, given us 2 visits, he hasn't even given us 1 yet. He says, that's not much of an apostle. So now he says, I've changed that. He says, that's not going to work because of circumstances. He says, I can't go across and go and do all and then come back and give you a sign. He says, I just don't have the time for it. But he said, what I will do, he said, I'm going to go up, not travel by sea. He says, I'm going to go up Macedonia, down to you about 700 miles. Across the sea was about 250 miles. He's going to take a 700 mile journey. You say he must have been fond of the scenery around those parts. Not at all. Why was he going to Macedonia? There was Philippi. And there was Thessalonica there. And then he said, I'll come down to you people. And instead of giving you 2 short visits, he says, it may be that I'll be able to spend the whole winter with you, maybe 3 or 4 months, and you'll get the benefit of 1 good long visit. But he said, I can only tell you that if the Lord. You know what's amazing? Those who have lived longer than I have will know more about this than I do, but it's amazing how many of your plans can be changed, even good plans. Some of you Christians never dreamt that the last year would take on the complexion it has taken on, and you'd planned, but the Lord has permitted things. The Apostle Paul often found the little plans that he had, even as an inspired apostle, he found those plans could be turned upside down in the permissive will of God. You'll find that, brethren and sisters. You know, the work of the Lord will never run along smoothly. There will always be an unpredictable thing about it. And very often when you think things are just getting into a nice, gentle groove, the whole apple cart will be upturned. And you think you can see the path clear in front of you for the foreseeable future, and you say, now I've got that nicely plot, and you see the way everything is fitted in. And you're just beginning to cruise along and fulfill this nice plan for so many miles and so many months ahead, and all of a sudden everything turns up and the Lord leaves you just hanging upon Him. Just as much as ever. If the Lord permits. Paul did make arrangements, but he cancelled them in. I do think, you know, assembly should make some arrangements. I know there's a great deal of consternation about arranged meetings and arranging this and arranging that. I know one dear brother, and if you want to have him here at a particular time of the year, the first year that he'd be able to come will be the year 2008. Suppose we should say, if the Lord permits. 2008. I don't know. I believe we should make plans. Whether we should just go as far forward as that, I'm not altogether sure. Whether I blame the brother for taking on the commitment, I'm not so sure whether I blame him or whether I blame the people that asked him. I think we need to be sensible. We can't organize the thing until it's just absolutely watertight. Paul didn't just have everything open, but it wasn't rigid and it wasn't closed, because there must be left. There must be, brethren and sisters, let's have order, let's have organization. But in this great work of the Lord, there must be. You know, there's another little addition, verse number 6. He says, it may be, at the start of the verse, I will venture with you, bring me on my journey, whithersoever I go. He didn't even seem to be exactly sure where he would go after that. Now, some dear folk to tell you, as I said already, exactly where they hope to be X years from now. Paul wasn't sure. He had the year planned out, roughly. But he said after that, he said, whithersoever I go, who really knows? Another thing that detained him and kept him in a place, and I have to mention this, and just we'll race on then, in verse number 8 and 9, he says, I have come across great advantages here at Ephesus. I will tarry at Ephesus until Pentecost, for a great door and effectual is opened unto me, and there are many adversaries. Now, this is a whole, opens up another pile of interesting material in connection with the work of the Lord. We should keep ourselves, rather than assembly or in whatever service it is, we should keep ourselves flexible enough so that should the Lord see fit to open a door unexpectedly, that we are free enough to take full advantage. Now he said, I'm here, he said, away. He said, if I was going to get all these things done that I wanted to do, he said, I should have been away before now. But he said, I'll tell you the truth. He says, the Lord has opened a door here at Ephesus. There's plenty of problems, plenty of adversaries. But he said, I feel that I should still stay. And I should change some of the other plans, because the demands of the work are just here. Now, what makes this so interesting? And I sort of have to go back into the book of the Acts here, and I'm assuming that you know about it. But way back in Acts chapter 16, the Apostle Paul just starting out on the second missionary journey. He leaves Antioch and he comes away across the country. He covers the territory that he had preached in his first missionary journey. And he gets onto the main road and he's heading straight for Ephesus. And he had his sights set upon that great city. But he said, the Spirit of the Lord forbade me to go there. He said, the door closed. He said, I couldn't get there. And he said, much to my dismay, and he said, I couldn't understand, he said, instead of going directly west, He said, I was quick up northwest into the hill country of what we now call Turkey. And he said, I ended going away up there. And he said, when I got up there, I still didn't know what to do. And he said, there was another door closed. And he said, I could find nothing to do. And then suddenly, he said, I landed in prison. And he said, the Lord sent an earthquake and the doors did open and a man got saved. So he said, the Lord put me away off track and he opened the door in Philippi that I never expected. And then he said, I came away back years later and he said, I found that he opened the door in Ephesus, the very place that he closed a number of years before. Now that gives us, at least it does to those who think about it, and I'm sure you can see it as plain as day, that gives us an indication that there could be things tried in the work of the Lord. And at one particular period, there'd be no headway whatsoever. I'm sure if you had some of the good, what we call missionary brethren, if you had many of them here tonight, and I know you have them here very often, if you listened carefully to what they would tell, they could tell about areas, and they would say, we went there and we preached, and we would get nobody to come to their meetings, and we struggled on until we just had to pack up. Then maybe 10 years later, they went back. And the thing just opened up miraculously. So that because a thing doesn't work one time, doesn't mean that it's closed for good. The Lord could open a door later, and we also can hear from this passage a very simple lesson. Wherever there will be opportunities, there will also be obstacles. There is a great door open, but there are many obstacles. Plenty of problems. It nearly broke his heart. He talked about trials and temptations day and night for the period of 3 years and so on. But all that was part and parcel of the work of the Lord. Well, I think I better leave that. There's plenty more to be said there. This is how it goes on, you see. It's not all plain sailing. It's not all easy planning. It doesn't all dovetail just as handy as we might think. The work of the Lord has many vexations. But there are times of progress, and it's great for us to have the eyes to see the door when the Lord does open them. You know, we should be aware, brethren, that we need to look for new doors in Northern Ireland. Like these doors around Windsor here, you're not making much headway with them. And you're doing just as well as we're doing about Lurgan. I gather from what I hear that the preachers that camped around these parts, this province, long before I was born, they made great headway hitting on the door. They found the door open. Visitation, going with a tract and in, and they got the people into their tents and halls and meetings, and God wrought, and they saw them saved, and that was marvelous. Now, I'm not saying that we give that up altogether, but remember, it doesn't produce very much nowadays. Those doors seem to have closed. Maybe we should be looking for doors into school. Maybe we should be looking for other doors. It could be that something that we have been doing, I'm not talking about changing the message. We can't change the message. There's no liberty to do. We didn't invent the message. We didn't create it. And we can't modify it. No, that's not the point. But there may be doors that we used to knock at that were open and were very fertile, and the Lord has allowed them to close. And instead of us standing stupid knocking at closed doors, it might be better if we were in touch with Him to turn our eyes and see other doors that may be opening. Paul says, it was closed, but it now has opened. If you turned over the page to 2 Corinthians, just after this, after he left Ephesus, he says, I went away up to Troas, 150 miles. And he says, when I got to Troas, he says, there was a door open for me to preach Christ's gospel. When I got there, he says, I was so under pressure because of things at Corinth. And he said, I knew things in the assembly away down at Corinth weren't getting on well. And he said, I had no rest. It's great for us to see, brethren and sisters, that these giants of the New Testament were just human beings. And Paul says the door was lying wide open.
And he said, I could see that there was just an invitation that had been providentially created.
Oh, brethren, the doors of opportunity swing on the hinges of providence.
May God give us eyes to see.
But he says, the door swung open. But he said, I was so agitated that I couldn't get out.
We had to leave it. I think there may have been a little bit of work done. He would gather that from later on. And he maybe was able to take advantage of it later. And when he did come back, he broke bread with the Christians at Stowe, you remember. All that kind of thing. But I'm just saying, there's a thing for some of the younger believers to do. You go through the passages of the New Testament where this figure of an open door is used. And you'll find them, the seven or eight of them, to be a very, very interesting study. All different connections. That'll do. I can't put any more about it now. Paul and his calendar. Forward planning in the work of God. Then, the work of the Lord doesn't only be carried on by plans, but it needs people. And the next little paragraph brings us to Paul and his colleague. There are two men, he wasn't doing it all, there are two men that he mentions here as Stichelae, and they were making a contribution different to his. The first man is Timothy in verse number 10 and 11, and then the second man is Apollos in verse number 12. Now he says, Timothy, I'll abbreviate this very, very quickly. He says, you people at Corinth, he says, if Timothy comes to you, he says, I have sent him. And he said, if he comes, he says, I don't want you to be intimidating him. He says, make him welcome. You can imagine what it was like for just what we would call a plain country boy from the little town of Lystra. And he finds himself going away to the great big city of Corinth with all its sophistication and a number of these highbrow Christians that were in the assembly. They're very influential people. And some of them well puffed up and with a great superiority complex. And poor Timothy comes into the likes of that. Now the Apostle Paul says, he says, you make him feel at home. And he says, don't be browbeating him. And he says, don't be making him feel at home. And don't despise him. It must have been quite a task for him. You know, I'm very thankful for the good welcome I've been given at Windsor. I can imagine a boy from the country coming to a big place like this with all the fears that there could be. And yet the brethren have made me feel very, very much at home, and they have made very generous allowances that we appreciate. Now Paul knew, he said, I want to... You'll not get the best. I said, he's a good one. He works the work of the Lord as I do. He said he's just moving exactly as I do. And he said, I'm telling you, if he goes to pay you a visit, he says he can give to you people a tremendous spiritual benefit. But he said, if you make them feel uncomfortable, and you put them under tension, and you intimidate them, well, he said, he'll not be able to relax. You know, there are places you can't relax. The work of the Lord, different places. You mightn't know that. I'm talking now from a preacher's standpoint, but never let on. It'll only affect about half a dozen here, and the rest of you will all forget them. There are places you're under tension when you go in to them home. No way they sit and look at you with their glasses. All that kind of thing. They sit with their head down, and they speak to you very condescendingly, and they just make you feel just like a grasshopper. That's all they are, isn't it? Well, it might be, but you know, there is. What I'm saying, I'm only going over that for this for reason. There is a way to teach people to get the best out. Not even talking about this teaching. You could bring somebody into the... You have to know... They tell me, I don't know how much they can vouch for it, but they say it very freely and frequently that Timothy was a timid, nervous nature. You see, well, I think there must be nearly a hole in my ribs with all these heartthumbs that you have going about preaching and so on. And Timothy must have known, a very timid, nervous preacher, and there might have been other people saying to Corinth, bumptious and bright, and they could have got in there, wouldn't have worried them a bit. You know, there are people, but Paul says, now, if you make it awful for this man, why would they have despised him? They might have despised him because of you. Sometimes that happens. I say nothing more about it.
say nothing more about that. Most people, from what I can observe, if they have enough patience, the problem disappears. They may have despised him because of his association. I imagine that there were some people at this time in the assembly at Corinth, and they had very little love for Paul. And because Timothy was doing the things the way Paul did them, there are companies of Christians in the north of Ireland today, and if you took Paul with you or started to talk about Paul in, you wouldn't have too long there to you to look at and scan. I know it's not true here. One thing I would say to the good brethren here at Windsor, always keep the door wide open for Paul. And all that he taught. There are places in the north of Ireland where they have taken a little bit of Paul's teaching and they have thrown it out. So they say we keep it for the morning meeting, but will we not bother with it for the prayer meeting? And this meeting and that meeting, and they throw Paul out just at their women fancy. And if you went and talked about Paul, you'd be anything but welcome. They might have despised him because of his age and because of association, and they might have despised him just because of sheer awkwardness. I mean, some people are just that awkward, they couldn't make it. That's not here. But none of these things that I'm talking about. But the work of the Lord, all these things have to be faced in the work of the Lord. There are ways. You Christians know it 10 times better than I do. There are ways of making the work, I say, easy. Never. There are ways of making it easy. And dear brethren, there are ways of making it more difficult. And some people are just so awkward and crooked. Well, I don't know. It's just a mercy that the whole work doesn't happen. Just see that he isn't. Send him out in peace. Send him home in peace. Ah, oh, that's a great thing. He says, don't be bringing him into a situation of fear. You've probably heard me tell it before. I remember sitting with a couple, and they shed bitter tears in a living room of their home, and they told me when they first went to the assembly, they couldn't wait until the time of the meeting came. With heaven on earth. And they were, it was genuine. They weren't making a whole big story. But great difficulties came in, and there was bitterness, and there was internal fighting. And they say now that we just dread the time of the meeting coming around. But they say you never go, but you come away from the meeting with a broken heart. And you're going to the meetings with fear. And they said, you're coming away with disappointment. Go with dread and come away with disappointment. I tell you, brethren and sisters, your work's not easy, but remember when meetings become a dread, it's something wrong. Christians get it so difficult, it should be a cheer to come to the assembly. Says, don't be bringing them into fear. Send them away in peace. Well, then the other man was Apollos, so now he lets them off, will we? He's worth talking about, you know. He's worth talking about, but we have no time for him tonight. So we'll have to apologize to Apollos. And that will keep everybody very, very happy. I want to come from Paul's calendar and Paul's colleagues to Paul's charge. In verses number 13 and 14, Paul gives, he's just like a military commander. There are a fivefold charge that he gives. Verse 14, 13 has four of them. Watch ye. Stand fast. Quit you like men. Be strong. Then the fifth one in verse 14, let all your things be done with love. Now those just come out with rapid fire. You can see that I'm not putting anything into them. I'm not forcing them when I say that they're just like the command of a commander would give to his soldiers. What? Stand fast. Quit yourselves like men. Be strong. There's a military flavor. You say, but you have to know the thing. The work's not like that.
Yeah.
You know, the work of the Lord is also a warfare. And the workers are also warriors. And the servants are also soldiers. The work field is also a battlefield. There have been quite a number of casualties in the assembly at Corinth. Things had gone badly there. And before the apostle puts down his pen, he says, if the work's going to go on, he said, I want to tell you people a number of things that you need. Now we look at them very, very briefly, just about 5 minutes or so left. The first is a great word of alert. He says, watch. That's getting the soldier up out of sleep. You know, I would have to confess that there's hardly anything needs to be more watched in a Christian's life than this journey. I'm not talking now about sin. We have to watch that. But it's very, very easy just to lapse into a state of carelessness and spiritual sleepiness. And you don't pay as much attention to private reading or private prayer. And you're not as alert as you should be. You know, there's one thing, dear brethren and sisters, that we can be sure about. The enemy's always on the watch. He never sleeps. And the arrows are flying. And the poisonous darts are always in the air. And the enemy is watching for every weakness. We have absolutely no time to drop our defense.
Watch.
Should I be speaking to some Christian here? But I want to make it practical just before we close. Some Christian here, and you're not just as watchful as you should. I'm not singling them out at all. I don't want to do that, but I want to speak to the students here. As one who dabbled very, very little in studies, the likes of what you're doing, I can say that there's nothing as easy when you're immersed in your study to neglect spiritual devotion. Now that old university campus where you circulate and you have to circulate, there's nothing wrong with that. We're not blaming you for that. But remember, it's a place that's infested with so many poisonous influences. You need to watch. Now I know there's exams, and I know there are tutorials, and I know there are deadlines to be met, there are assignments to be prepared, but you do your best to spend a little time every day before you go out and read and pray. God for Saturday, watch. And let us all watch. You know, preachers need to watch. I don't need to tell you that. Overseers need to watch. Older Christians need to watch. Younger Christians. Younger. Then there's the word of Elijah. He says, I don't only want you to watch, but he says, I want you to stand fast in the faith. Stand firm. He said, don't allow yourselves to be shifted. He says, the people that are marked by conviction. He says, know what you believe. And he says, know why you believe it. Now sometimes you wonder why maybe the good brethren that come here and you hear another says, they keep going over the same things, assembly truths and the basics of Christian living and separation and sanctification and all these different things. You wonder why they keep going over that. I hear tremendous complaints that there are many people, I don't know if it's true or not, I wouldn't make the complaint personally. I hear it especially in other parts of the British Isles, and here too. I hear it said that there are many people in assembly fellowship, but they don't really know why they're there. Now you couldn't say about those people that they're standing firm in the faith. We need to get good ground beneath the feet, and we need to stand. Stand fast. Be like the man that stood in the barley and he held the sword until it clung to his hand. The rest were gone away, but he said, this is God's inheritance, and he said, I'm going to stand fast. You say, how do I stand firm? That is firm in the faith. We should have a little bit of discussion whether that means the Bible or whether it means trust in God. I'll not take time to do anything more about that. I was just reading today. I still read Pilgrim's Progress sometimes. You'll forgive me for that, but I was reading it today. And Bunyan was a great man in the work of the Lord. You know, I was just thinking that he lived almost the same years as another man called Richard Baxter. They lived in the 17th century, a couple of years either end from each other. And they each did a tremendous work for God in their own way. Richard Baxter was a student. John Bunyan was a thinker. And I would say, I would nearly think for this audience tonight, that the most of you people know a good bit more about John Bunyan than you do about Richard Baxter. And Richard Baxter was a far deeper man. The other man was just a very, very simple man. You know, there is an idea. There is an idea now that you can do nothing for God unless you're professional and polished. You know, the thinker has done something that has affected more lives than the theologian ever did. But that's by the way. God has a place in his work for all different things. That's the context in which I'm saying. But there's a man in his book and he calls him Stanfast. The pilgrims were coming along and they saw this character on the highway and he was down on his knees with his hands up. And they wondered what was wrong with him. And they came on and asked him his name and said his name was Stanfast. And they said, well, he said he was an awful difficulty. And he had been crying to God to deliver him. And what had happened was that Madame Bubbles had met him. She's a wonderful lady. She's as large as life. She came out, she's an old witch lady, a good age, you see. But she was well plastered up and so on, and nicely dressed. And she had a great big purse with the money dangling just beside her. And she stepped out into the road, and she promised him happiness and success. But she said, you'll have to come with me. And he got down and he cried before God. And the big problem was he going to follow this colorful lady with her full purse? Or was he going to stand fast? So it's all tonight. May God help us to stand fast. Many dear believers were doing well in the work of the Lord until they met the lady with the big purse. They dipped their fingers into one or two of her coins, and she said, I'll promise you happiness if you come to work for me. And they had kind of way edged off the path of the Lord's work, and they got involved in material things. You know, all of us need to watch and stand fast, because big Madame Bubble. And the trouble with Madame Bubble is that someday she'll burst, and all her money disappear, and you'll be left with nothing. But those that put their energies into the work of the Lord are investing it in something that will abide for all eternity.
Watch! Stand fast! Quit you like men!
I'm not sure what that means either. I called it the word of agapete. It's a word of courage. It could refer to the fact that there's a manly. I do fear. As I hurry to a close, I fear, you know, that some of us are too chicken-hearted to be much use for God in these days. Some of the Christians would run if they saw a mouse coming into the gospel hall. I mean, a spiritual mouse. If Goliath walked in, I don't know where they'd find it. They'd be right out in Copeland Island or somewhere.
Quit yourself like men, he said. Be like men. I've quoted it 1,000 times because it must have stuck in me. I was very lately started to go to gospel meetings. Our brother Robert McKeith was preaching on being a good soldier of Jesus Christ. And the manliness and the discipline and the courage. He said, be good soldiers of Jesus Christ. And he looked in the way he could do it. He said, good soldiers of Jesus Christ. He said that most of the Christians wouldn't even make good Boy Scouts. I think it's true. We wouldn't even make good boys, but be like men. Let us have a Saturday. Let us stand at our post. Far too many deserters and fifth columnists. Stand firm. Have conviction. Stay at your post.
and with agathebe. That word agathebe that I'm using to put over it, sometimes it can refer to a boldness that's unmannerly. You know, that should never mark those who are in the work of the Lord. Sometimes, people have used what they call about standing for the truth. People have used this passage for them. That's a great slogan, isn't it? Standing for the truth. And they use the slogan, standing for the truth, as an excuse for lewdness. And I say, brethren and sisters, we should discern. We should be convicted. God expects us all this to be. The cause of truth has never been helped by coarse truth. Let us have spiritual audacity with dignity. And he said, be strong, that's the word of ability. And I close with affection. You've done all those things, it might sound a wee bit hard. He says, well, forget about the soldier, bit of it is. He says, let all your never let charity go away. There must be truth, but there must always be tenderness. There must be loyalty coupled with love. There must be conviction coupled with compassion. I trust that God will help us to listen to the charge of the Apostle Paul, because if these five things are true in our life, there's one thing I'm sure about. With each one being able to make a good contribution to the ongoing work. Our Father, we commend ourselves to thee again in the precious name of the Lord Jesus. We thank thee for the principles that we find in thy word abiding from the first century. We praise thee for men like Apollos and Timothy and thy servant Paul and the others that we will find mentioned in this chapter. And we thank thee for all who bear similar characteristics to the present day. We think of all the saints gathered at this meeting. We thank thee for so many that have borne faithful testimony over a considerable period of years. And remember those who are beginning to bear it. We ask, Lord, that thou wilt give us the necessary grace and wisdom and preservation and resilience in the midst of that, of which it worries. And society to which we pass. We need thine help. We thank thee for bringing us together. We came together in the name of thy Son. And we ask thy blessing now as we just separate in that same worthy, holy, and precious name. Just a verse or two of number 100. Number 98. Hymn number 98. Hark, 'tis the watchman's cry, wake, brethren.